Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
Welcome to the Coming In for a Landing podcast on the Liberty Ballers podcast network. Here's your host, Paul Hudrick.
Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Coming In for a Landing podcast on the Liberty Ballers podcast network. I am your host, Paul Hudrick, and I am joined by a very special guest. You know him from NBC Sports Philadelphia, their Sixers insider, and also I guess we call you a co-host or a frequenter of the Sixers Talk podcast. I don't know how we label that, but that is, of course, my good friend, Noah Levick. Noah, thank you so much for joining me, man.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be back on for the first time since you are a father. So it's a joy for me to be talking Sixers basketball as always, but especially in that new context.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And I wanted to bring him on for you. I just wanted to, you know, let you meet him via Zoom, but unfortunately he's had a little bit of a tough morning and he's sleeping it off right now with mom. So we'll eventually you'll meet Miles and hopefully meet Miles in person soon enough. Cause that will be, he's got to meet Levick the legend. He's got to understand our relationship and friendship. So yeah. But we are here to talk some Philadelphia 76ers basketball. Last night, tough loss, just seemed like a lot of factors, you know, they hadn't played a good basketball team since they beat Brooklyn on December 30th. I think that was a factor, you know, the beat up on some bad teams and maybe the intensity level kind of wasn't quite there from the onset. I think Seth Curry looked a little off coming back from his injury. Tyrese Maxey as well had a really good start. And then I thought he kind of disappeared in the second half. That also could be a matter of him not fully being back after he had a longer absence. And then, you know, I thought the Charlotte Hornets strategy was good against Joel. I thought they did a pretty good job defensively on him, despite the fact that he still scores 31 points, gets the franchise, ties the franchise mark for straight 30 point games with Allen Iverson and Wilt Chamberlain. But no, I just wanted your impressions of the game last night. Their 7-game win streak snapped and just what you kind of saw as the biggest factors there.
I think there were a combination of issues, some of which were familiar with lack of athleticism, lack of shot creation around Embiid, shaky execution against zone defense, and then some problems that you can probably attribute to not being as focused as they should have been for this game against a Hornets team that, in my view, it is better than the record and was coming off back-to-back wins against the Bucks. And I think you saw that problem most with some head-scratching, mind-boggling turnovers. The one which was most in that category for me was Andre Drummond trying a behind-the-back pass in the fourth quarter of a game where his team is trying to make a comeback push.
Nobody in the vicinity. Just nobody there.
Not even close. To his credit, like 30 seconds later, he's throwing a beautiful long outlet to Furkan Korkmaz, but a situation where the Sixers did not need him to be that adventurous as a passer. And Seth Curry had some bad turnovers. Tobias Harris did as well. Also a few tough whistles with offensive fouls and be picked up too early in the game, which he said post-game did affect him and made him feel like he couldn't be quite as aggressive as he wanted, especially defensively. So confluence of issues in this game that all resulted in the Sixers digging a hole for themselves that they weren't able to climb out of.
You mentioned something right off the top, and I think it's like you said, it's familiar issues. It's things we're all aware of. And it makes me almost want to ask a different question. You talked about, you know, the lack of athleticism and the lack of shot creation. Because of that, it just feels like they almost have to be perfect everywhere else, right? Like they almost have to be perfect in their execution of their offense. They have to play really good defense, or else for instance, the Hornets, their athleticism and their shot creation can sometimes make up for the fact that they're not a very good defensive team, and that perhaps they do play, you know, maybe not always the smoothest basketball and sometimes play a little bit too much one-on-one, but you can get away with that when you have guys that can create their own shot. When you have athleticism, you can get out on the break. And I thought, you know, it's interesting when you talk about officiating, because I don't want to, like, clearly, like, if you're a good enough team, the whistle shouldn't matter. Like, you should be able to play through it. But one, yeah, I thought it was noticeable that Joel definitely, it changed him once he picked up the second one, and then they picked up the third one in the second half. I thought that definitely messed with him a little bit. I thought the whistle in general messed with both teams. And I also thought, I kind of felt like, and you can, you know, if you agree or disagree, but it felt like Charlotte's strategy was almost, well, Joel Embiid is going to get fouled, and he's going to go to the line a ton, so let's just hack him because they're not going to call everything. And like, it almost felt, because like he had seven turnovers, and I felt like, yeah, three of them were clearly offensive fouls, but then I thought a couple of them were plays where maybe he would have gotten the benefit of a whistle, or maybe he didn't as much. I don't blame Charlotte for that strategy. I kind of almost respect it and almost kind of think that more teams should do it. Like, he's going to get to the line double digit times every game just because he's so big, he's so dominant, he's so skilled. It's just most teams don't have the physical presence to match him. So you're going to foul him a bunch. He's going to go to the line. So why not just kind of just foul him? You know, both opposing centers had five, both Plumlee and PJ Washington both had five fouls. And I think that was a result of that. I think you're going to get called for fouls anyway, so you might as well be aggressive. So I give credit to Charlotte for that. I think too, James Borrego is a pretty damn good coach. He coaches them up pretty well, because they're not a great defensive team, but at least they show effort and they do put something forth. But do you kind of see it as that? As like, because they do lack in those areas, that the Sixers almost have to be perfect in every other capacity?
I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but I think it's fair to say that they have a low margin for error generally against high quality opponents, especially when Embiid is not having an otherworldly performance and does make a few mistakes himself. Just team identity wise, like, something that's been different this year is the Sixers are actually a low turnover group without Ben Simmons, and they're a team that's, you know, among the bottom groups in the NBA as far as pace is concerned. So it's more deliberate, careful basketball than some of the freewheeling style that is characteristic of Ben Simmons and previous Sixers teams. And I think that goes hand in hand with just can't make too many mistakes, need to execute well, need to be focused, and you're going to be punished if at the beginning of the game you're not as ready to play as you should be. And that's been an issue, you know, quite a few times this season. So, and I thought it was, again, problematic last night. I think Joel Embiid, so much is on his shoulders. Especially this year, we've seen him doing more with the transition playmaking, doing more as essentially the point guard of the offense, handling the ball at the top of the key. And I don't think that is inherently wrong, because he's proven he can handle it and he's proven he can take on those jobs well. But it is an issue when Seth Curry is, you know, just kind of casually throwing the ball to the other team as he tries to hit Embiid on a high-low. And it's an issue when the offense isn't in sync and in rhythm and flowing the way it had against these lower quality opponents.
Right. And you know, you touched on the turnovers, and I know for you personally, you are a big fan of guards who do not turn the ball over. But I have to ask, with Maxey, do you find sometimes that almost, like, it's a great thing that he doesn't turn the ball over? And I agree with you. I think the Sixers don't have as much room for error when you don't have a Ben Simmons, and when you're kind of so reliant on Joel Embiid, it taking care of the basketball becomes pretty important. But do you almost think that maybe sometimes you would sacrifice a Maxey turnover or two for him to perhaps be a little bit more adventurous as a playmaker?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I did a little film review on our website on Max earlier this season, and basically came to that same conclusion, which I don't think should be especially controversial. We're not trying to say Maxey should be ultra risky with his play or
right,
that it's not a good thing that he preserves the ball really well. But I think just overall, the Sixers have been consistent with the messaging of we're a better team when Maxey is aggressive and when Maxey is looking to attack the paint and put pressure on the rim. Because we all know when he does that, like, the results are superb. And it's just a question of him doing that a little more. I think as far as his performance last night in particular, you know, wouldn't it make sense to be overly critical of that given the circumstances? If he was sitting in a hotel room dealing with an asymptomatic COVID case and not able to do a ton basketball-wise and just getting back into the flow of things last night. But I do agree with the overall point that there's a fine balance there. And I think him just putting the foot on the gas, it tends not to be a bad thing for the Sixers, even if slightly increased turnover numbers are a byproduct.
Right. And especially like you get off to like, I 100% agree with you. Him, like last night, you can't gauge much from that performance and you can't really put too much stock into it because of what, you know, the circumstances and the context of it. But I was really encouraged because at the end of the first quarter, he drains those two threes and they were threes. Like, those are the kind of threes that could make him so dangerous when you're talking about one off the screen, off the dribble from Drummond, and then the other one being a step back above the break. I mean, those are two shots that goes into a scouting report. Like, that goes into a defense's mind for the next time they play against him, and, you know, makes a difference. He was coming off a game where he hit, you know, a career high five, and Brooklyn hasn't played since, unfortunately. And then even the first play, you know, the first possession of the game, the ball gets swung to him in the corner. He does, you know, a taxi over aggressive closeout with a pump fake and hits a floater. Like, I think going forward, I would just like to say, I think he is building, he's made progressions enough where I think he needs to feel more comfortable being a bigger part of the offense. Cause I think a big part of his issue is that he just simply defers because Joel Embiid is so great, because Joel Embiid and Seth Curry just have such a connection and sometimes they roll. And even Tobias Harris, I think he just wants to defer. He wants to keep all the veterans happy when, you know, like you had already mentioned, when he's getting downhill, when he's being aggressive, it seems to be what is best for the team. So I think going forward, we would like to see a little bit more of that. In the second half, you know, clearly he didn't, you know, he kind of disappeared, for lack of a better word. But I think, as you already discussed, the you know, him being in the health and safety protocols, missing so much time, was clearly a factor there. And one of the things Doc did in that second half when they were, you know, I didn't agree with him doing it at all. And I really didn't necessarily agree with the timing when he went to that two big lineup with Embiid and Drummond, as Danny Green affectionately called it, what was it, the King Kong Godzilla lineup. I understood why he did it in Orlando. They were playing an inferior team. They were getting killed on the glass. And, you know, they were also extraordinarily shorthanded. So he was just trying to do something different. I have to say, I didn't understand him going to it here, because I thought they actually had crept back into the game simply because, as we've already touched on, the effort level had gone up. And I thought really that was the reason they had gotten back to the game more than anything, not necessarily a lineup or a certain player. I just thought they had stepped it up a notch on both ends of the floor. Seth Curry did get going a little bit, and that certainly helped, but I thought it was more the collective effort. So I guess for you, what were your thoughts when Doc went to it initially, and then what did you see out of it when it was out there, that lineup?
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts when he went to it initially were, I guess, predominantly surprised. So I didn't think Andre Drummond was having a good game up until that point. So I saw Embiid going to the scorer's table to check in for his final stint. And I just assumed, okay, Drummond's done. Time to see if Embiid can lead this comeback down the stretch. Then realize, oh, the Twin Towers are playing together here. I just was also surprised by it because of Charlotte's personnel and play style. And I think part of the reason Drummond struggled at times is that the Hornets are a smaller, more athletic team. And also, he wasn't really doing great at his strengths of rebounding the ball. I mean, there was one possession in this game where, with Drummond on the court, the Hornets grabbed three offensive rebounds, which just shouldn't happen. And he wasn't making free throws. He wasn't scoring inside. He just wasn't contributing positively overall. So I think it's a little more understandable if Drummond is a little bit of a hot hand or the matchup is good for Drummond that you go with the King Kong Godzilla duo. But I didn't think Drummond played well last night, and then having Embiid share the floor with him did not benefit Joel Embiid, I think, is the bottom line. You know, I don't think it was a horrendous move or indefensible. Doc Rivers had a simple explanation post-game that he just thought his team was playing awful, so might as well try something. I mean, fair enough. But when you do that, you're also open to criticism and scrutiny when the unorthodox decision you make does not work. The minutes weren't disastrous. You know, there were a couple even, times. Yeah, that, you know, they hooked up on a few high lows. The defense mostly held its own and forced Charlotte into tough looks. But I am on the same page that I didn't think it was the move to make. I thought, if anything, he might consider playing a small ball lineup last night, in part again because I thought Drummond wasn't playing well. So I thought maybe we'd see George Niang or Tobias Harris at center to sort of go like for like with the Hornets, but he went very much in the opposite direction, and it did not work.
Yeah, you raise a couple good points. The one thing that sticks out is, yeah, I mean, that Orlando game, Drummond had been playing well, so it made a lot more sense because Drummond was playing better, and like you said, and with the play style, I think, is really important too. With Orlando, I mean, they have a couple bigs, like, you know, so it kind of made more sense to do that. And yeah, like I actually wasn't thinking that, but you're right. It would have probably made more sense to maybe try. That would have been a good opportunity to try Niang against PJ Washington at the five. I think that would have made a lot more sense at that point in the game. And then the other factor too is you mentioned before, you know, Charlotte having success with the zone and the Sixers not having success with it. I don't think the move to combat the zone is then to go with a center who doesn't shoot from the outside to play with your other center. So yeah, I thought it was kind of counterintuitive in that sense as well. And then, you know, I just with that two big lineup, I just really don't, I get it. Like you said, I get it in the sense when another team has that play style, has two bigs, is a more plotting opponent, but I don't get it against Charlotte. I will say this, though. The reason you can kind of get away with it, why I thought they kind of played even with them, Joel Embiid guarded Miles Bridges. Like, that was his assignment defensively. And I thought he probably guarded Miles Bridges better than Tobias Harris did in the first half. So, I mean, that just speaks more to how special Joel Embiid is and how, you know, what his skill and his amazing abilities allows you to kind of do, and some of the things it allows you to get away with.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll have more with Noah Levick on the other side.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
I would be remiss, Noah, if we went this whole podcast and we didn't talk at all about Ben Simmons, and now the noise is starting to pick up a little bit now that, you know, teams are kind of, I don't want to say, you know, getting over COVID, but it's, you know, I guess everyone's learning how to deal with it, which isn't great, but that's the reality of the situation. So I think some front offices are now getting to a point. We saw a trade today, Cam Reddish, who I would have liked as a Sixers target, not as a primary guy in a Ben Simmons return, but maybe as a part of it. He goes to the New York Knicks in exchange for a conditional first round pick, some other things, moving parts there as well. But the point is that the wheels appear to be greased a little bit. We're hearing some rumors. Then we're also hearing some cold water being thrown on those rumors. So I'm really curious, Noah. You're a guy whose opinion I really trust, and I think you're one of the more even-keeled, more balanced people out there on the beat. So I would really like to get your thoughts on the idea of, you know, two of the bigger teams that have been mentioned, the Kings, who are clearly in desperation mode, who Sam Amick of the Athletic has suggested that Tyrese Halliburton or De'Aaron Fox could be had if the price is right. And then you look at Atlanta, you know, according to multiple reports, Atlanta has been interested in Ben Simmons. Some whispers about John Collins, and, you know, it does make sense from a salary standpoint that he would be one of the guys. So I guess I want to start with, I know it's tough because you don't know all the offers, you don't know everything that's out there, but let's say hypothetically we're sitting there on February 10th and it's nearing 3 p.m. and the best deal you have on the table is something like Tyrese Halliburton, Buddy Hield, maybe a pick, let's say a first round pick from the Kings for Ben Simmons. Do you take that, or do you think, without, I know it's tough because you don't have the knowledge, or do you think it's better to keep Ben Simmons past the deadline, let him sit out an entire season, and then try again in the offseason?
It's borderline for me. It wouldn't be an offer that I enthusiastically accept in Daryl Morey's position. I will say that. I think the major, major unknown variable here that, of course, Morey and the Sixers decision makers are best positioned to evaluate is the likelihood that a superstar deal is legitimately feasible post-deadline. And then obviously a new factor to consider here is Damian Lillard had surgery on his abdomen and is out for an extended period of time. So, you know, as far as Lillard is concerned, that's another thing that the Sixers have to consider. I like Halliburton a lot. I think, of course, if you're looking at the Kings guards, Halliburton would theoretically be a better fit on this roster than Fox, although Fox would certainly help with the accelerated pace and adding a little juice and transition offense to the Sixers style. But Halliburton, obviously a much better three-point shooter and someone who I think would project to be a nice complementary kind of player around a star like Joel Embiid, and also you know, capable of playing next to Tyrese Maxey in large part because of the shooting ability and the playmaking ability, you know, with his skill as a passer, and also a good transition playmaker in his own right. So like Tyrese Halliburton, not super high on Buddy Hield in isolation, but if he does anything well, it's shoot, and he's sure willing to shoot, which, as we've discussed, has been something that Joel Embiid has long desired from his teammates.
They can use a guy who will jack up 10 threes a game. That would not be a bad thing to have.
Buddy Hield will do that every night if you give him the chance. So I think overall, like, it's a decent offer. It's an intriguing offer. I don't think it's a great offer or one I jump out of my seat to accept because, you know, as we've said a million times, as flawed as Ben Simmons is, he is still only 25 years old. He has made 3 All-Star games. He's one of the league's best and most versatile defenders and all of that. So I guess my overall assessment would be borderline with a few caveats and a few very important unknown variables.
For sure. Because it's such a risky proposition. I could see it, and this is going to sound like a cop-out for me, but I can see it both ways when I look at it from Daryl Morey's perspective. Because, yes, you could pull the trigger on that move, and I think Hield and Halliburton make you a better team. Do they make you better than a second-round team in Eastern Conference? I'm not so sure. You know, playing them with Joel Embiid certainly makes a difference, and I feel confident he will bring out the best in both of those players. But at the same time, I would have, you know, a little bit of pause, because then you'd be, you know, I guess your starting backcourt is what, Maxey and Halliburton, and you're counting on two 21-year-olds to try to lead you on a playoff run when you're a team that's trying to, you know, contend for a title. And the part of the reason you want to make a move is to help Joel Embiid in his prime, you know, in one of his prime seasons. And I don't know that bringing in another 21-year-old guard is accomplishing that. And then the other factor is, but then, like, if you're looking at it on the positive side, you know, they do help you right now. They make you a better team right now. They certainly help you more than a Ben Simmons who's not playing. And then theoretically, if you wanted to still go big game fishing, whether it's Lillard, whether it's Beal, whether it's Hart, whatever, you still have a Tyrese Halliburton is still a really attractive piece, you would think, for a team who's rebuilding, which one of those teams that has one of those guys would be. And then Hield is a guy that can match, you can match contracts with, and then you still have picks, whether it's, you know, picks you're getting from Sacramento or, you know, your own, other than I think 2025 is the only one that'll be due to the Thunder for in the Al Horford deal. But other than that, the Sixers have most of their first round picks. So you'd still have assets if you made, if you pulled the trigger on that, you'd still have assets to go big game hunting. But at the same time, I think you raise an excellent point where I think, I get the last time we saw Ben Simmons, it wasn't pretty, but this is still an immensely talented 25-year-old player. So, you know, in this summer, what's more attractive to a team? The possibility of, you know, if you're looking at Sacramento, is it more, not even Sacramento, you're looking at the other teams, like what's more attractive, you know, getting Ben Simmons at 25 years old with that contract or getting Tyrese Halliburton? And I think some people would say that Ben Simmons would still unquestionably be the more valuable and more attractive trade piece. So it's a gamble, man. It's a big risk if you do that. If you hold on to him past February and you go big game hunting, it's a gamble. But at the same time, again, it feels like all the time superstars are on the move in the NBA. It's been a weird time frame where that kind of hasn't happened in a little bit here. So when you look at the possibility of Damian Lillard maybe being traded this offseason, Bradley Beal, who knows, with him and his extension. James Harden has been a name that's thrown out there. I don't see him leaving the Nets, but I guess you never know, and it's a possibility. When you look at the Celtics situation and Jalen Brown and where they go from here, see how their season plays out. So, I mean, there could be players that will be theoretically available that maybe it would be better to hang on and wait till the offseason as opposed to just pulling the trigger on a Tyrese Halliburton move. The other team that, again, that we that's kind of been in the news is the Hawks, and I think Ben makes a lot of sense for them in a lot of ways. Collins has been the guy that has been talked about. I like John Collins an awful lot. I think he's a pretty good player, and I think he's 24, and I think you could make the argument he's still an ascending player. But I think the biggest issue with the Sixers is you're talking about him and Tobias Harris and that fit there. So I guess we'll start with, I probably already know your answer, but I'll ask you anyway. Do you envision a world where John Collins and Tobias Harris could play together for the Sixers? And then going forward, there are also rumors that Tobias Harris is a name that could be moved as, you know, I guess basically essentially I don't want to say a salary dump because I think that's unfair to Tobias Harris, who I still think is a pretty good player despite his struggles. But I guess first we'll touch on, do you think Collins and Harris would be a fit? And if not, do you think that if the Sixers are able to move Tobias Harris, that Collins would be a guy that they would have interest coming back in a different deal?
Yeah, I think Collins and Harris could play together on a playoff team. Do I think it's at all likely that they could share the floor on a championship contender? No. I mean, clearly, there are some redundancies there, and it would make sense, of course, for the Sixers to see if they can include Tobias Harris in some of these Ben Simmons trade offers and create a little bit of an opening there where they're more easily able to acquire, a power forward sort of player. As we've talked about, I think with John Collins, the ability to be a high-quality backup center behind Joel Embiid is intriguing and a major plus. I think for so long, this backup center situation hasn't been stable. Even this year, Andre Drummond has added some good things to the table, but he's on a one-year contract, and he's a player that is not suited for all situations the same way that John Collins is. John Collins, obviously not a beefy guy, you know, perhaps would not be ideal for matchups against hulking centers, but there aren't many of those in the NBA these days. And again, John Collins has played a bunch of backup center minutes for the Hawks, and just the ability to back up Embiid and then also play well alongside him, I think is appealing. I don't think he's a top 25, top 30 difference maker caliber sort of player. And I think, yeah, Tobias Harris has to be elsewhere for the notion of, does John Collins significantly elevate the Sixers to a substantial degree to even really be something, you know, that we're discussing, is how I see that.
With Tobias, I have a couple of questions. First of all, you see the whispers, and now it seems like it's more than a whisper because now it's being reported by multiple people. You see the report that they're trying to move Tobias Harris along with Ben Simmons in a deal. What was your initial reaction when you saw that report?
Just that trying and succeeding are different things. Yeah. Makes sense to gauge interest and try to pitch that, but it's a big contract that, you know, it's very difficult to imagine other teams wanting to take on. But hey, can't hurt to ask questions and make your case. And evidently, that's how the Sixers front office feels based on the reports.
Yeah, let me put it to you this way. Do you glean anything off of that rumor? Like, as in, do you take that as there maybe isn't the value they would like right now for Ben Simmons, so maybe another way to get value is to get off Tobias's contract, and that's a way where maybe they feel more comfortable taking a guy like Collins because, one, you're making him fit better, but then also you're creating, you know, you're becoming a little bit more flexible, possibly financially?
Perhaps. I know that I believe Tom Moore from Bucks County Courier Times reported that part of the thinking with having Harris in discussions is, of course, if you trade him, then you are able to get back a power forward. So just positionally, that it expands the number of players that you could acquire in a Ben Simmons trade. Collins, obviously, the perfect example of that concept. But I just think the willingness to include him, to me, it shows Morey in the front office are attempting to be creative and explore every option and not leave stones unturned. But I'm not sure I glean anything profound from it other than that. Obviously, it's an indication that, as opposed to when they first signed Harris, it sure doesn't seem like they see him any longer as an ascendant player with heaps of untapped potential. But I think overall, it's not a development that I consider incredibly meaningful.
Fair enough. Yeah. And I mean, on top of Collins, I mean, one of the most kind of attractive guys out there is another power forward in Domantas Sabonis, who, again, like, I think there could be a theoretical fit with Joel Embiid, but there's just no fit when you're talking about Tobias Harris, Domantas Sabonis, and Joel Embiid. If you can perhaps, you know, again, move off of Tobias's contract, you can go with a starting lineup of something like Maxi Curry, Danny Green for shooting, and then Sabonis at the four, Embiid at the five. And then also Sabonis, similar to Collins, in that you can play him some backup five and, you know, have him do some pick and pop stuff in the second unit and all that. And he's a very good rebounder as well, which would solve a pretty glaring issue for the Sixers as well. But as long as Tobias Harris is here, that's just totally not realistic. But I also want to touch on too, Noah. You were there last night at the game at the arena, and post game, Doc Rivers and Tobias Harris both kind of reacted to the rumors that are out there. And it just seems like with Tobias, and I think like, listen, let's just get it out. Like, he makes a lot of money. He makes it, he's a near max player, and he's near max contract, but he's just not to that level of player. That's just a reality that I think everyone who watches basketball, that covers basketball, could agree on. At the same time, there is a human element to this. And the guy had COVID this year, came back, had a hip issue, then had, I guess what you could say is the flu, missed a bunch of time there. Now it was revealed by Chris Haynes of Yahoo that he received an MRI and apparently is dealing with some tendonitis in his right shoulder. I'm sure that is not helping his shooting at all. You saw the tape on it last night. So I guess, Noah, just the human element of this and just Tobias's response and Doc's response, you know, when you're there in person, just kind of what, you know, I guess take people in that aren't there, take them into that scenario when you're watching like what Tobias, you know, his response to those kind of questions.
Right. I think just with Harris in particular, it's telling to me how open he's been this year about his health. Because I know in the past there have been one or two occasions, I know when I like asked about ailments, where he didn't want to reveal much and clearly took pride in being a durable player. And this is someone who's played 82 games, you know, multiple times and just was a workhorse for much of his NBA career. And this year he's been very upfront about what he's dealing with. As you mentioned, first going through some significant COVID symptoms, missed 6 games for that, and then had these lingering effects that he was also candid about. And then last night, it just struck me as a weird situation, frankly, that he hadn't been on any injury reports, that he's listed as probable with right shoulder pain. And then this report comes out that you mentioned that the shoulder pain is specifically tendonitis. And then I you know, asked about it after the game, and he revealed this is something that happened in November 16th in Utah. So we're talking about, you know, about 2 months ago almost. And he acknowledged that he still feels it every day, and he described it as an irritating pain. I know, you know, fans don't want to hear excuses from him now. They just want him to play better. But the reality is he has valid excuses. And in my mind, this is one of them. And you look at the numbers, his shooting has been worse since he says he suffered this right shoulder injury. He's been about 28% from three, 43% from the floor. And that's logical to me. The right shoulder, that's an important part of your shot, like, obviously. So I think he is frustrated. We know the fan base is frustrated. And we appreciate, you know, as reporters, him being honest about both his physical and mental state. I mean, with the trade rumor specifically, he said he did, you know, didn't really want to get into it, but he acknowledged it was, I think his words were, taking too much of his energy the last couple of days. So he is not oblivious to the rumors out there. He sees it all, and ideally you're able to block that out as a player and have tunnel vision, but I just don't think that is possible in many of these cases. And it's clearly been a difficult season for him, and he's struggling with a lot of factors outside of his control. And then also the factors within his control aren't going very well. You know, some of the decision making continues to be plotting, and the isolation basketball hasn't yielded great results and all of that. But to me, it's a nuanced situation here with Harris. And I think, you know, any honest assessment of the situation has to have some degree of sympathy just with all of the things that he has gone through and is continuing to go through.
For sure. He's, you know, you could say, again, you want to, you know, critique his play. You want to say that he's overpaid, all those things. Yeah, all that's fair game. But at the same time, he is a guy that has played, I think it was the hand, right? He had the hand tape for like months and never, it was never on the injury report. He never told anybody about it. He was asked about it and never said a word about it. He said it was fine. But clearly it's not. If you're getting taped every night, there's clearly a lingering issue there. So, I mean, I like you said, it's commendable. It's extremely commendable that he wants to be, he doesn't want to make excuses for himself. He wants to play every night. He wants to be known as a guy who's durable and can play all 82 and all that. I wonder perhaps if at some point, if he's going to continue to struggle like this, perhaps he needs to just step aside and say, you know what, my shoulder, it's not great. I'm not helping the team right now. Maybe I need to take a step back. I don't know that he gets to that point because, as we mentioned, he is such a prideful person. And you go, again, say whatever you want about the guy, but the dude is tough. He does, he works really hard. And you mentioned the thing with the fans. That's really out of character for him. So I think that's a sign of how much this season and everything's really weighing on him, because that's not something he's done. He's always been really appreciative of the fans and always been good to the fans. And even when they've been down on him in times in the past, he hasn't kind of responded in that way. So to see that reaction, you knew, like, it's clear it's physical, it's mental. And you know, you just like, and that's all I want to say. You know, I think you conveyed it very well, Noah, but I just want to, you know, reiterate that there is such a human element to this. And to, you know, as much as you want to put Tobias Harris in your trade machines, and I get it, and it's all fair, just keep that human element in your head when you're assessing his play, when you're assessing the team, and when you're looking at the team overall. That's going to be it for us. I want to thank my guest, Noah Levick, Sixers insider at NBCSportsPhiladelphia.com. You can go check out all of his outstanding work there, as well as the Sixers Talk podcast. I'm sure we will have Noah on again in the near future. For now, I am your host, Paul Hudrick. I want to say thank you all so much for listening to the Coming In for a Landing podcast on the Liberty Ballers Podcast Network. Please rate, subscribe, and download wherever you get your podcast. And I will talk to you guys next time.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.